but it's so nice to know that the column is still hanging around for the old days. Few cultures have tossed the word love around more than our Western culture does or has done in recent years. And yet we all know that there are a lot of people around who find great difficulty in finding the quality of loving personal relationships that they really want. This is true whether you're straight or whether you're gay. It seems as though love is very elusive for a lot of people. And of course, quite often into that vacuum, that love vacuum, empty sex steps to fill the breach. It's tempting to ask, what's gone wrong? Eric Fromm, in his book The Act of Loving, blames it all on the capitalist economic system. He says capitalism has made real love impossible by cultivating self-interest too much in our culture. So that people don't really love one another anymore, they just use one another for the fulfillment of their various personal needs. It's a kind of commercial contract, like a car owner uses a mechanic to service his car, so we use one another, he says. Other sociologists I've read have drawn attention to the eroticization of society in recent years. I guess it's the same over here as it is in my country. 40 years ago in London, the publication of D.H. Lawrence's novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, was sufficient to merit a high court action under the Obscene Publications Act. It was so considered so scandalous. Now, 40 years on, we have pornographic videos thinly disguised as sex education documents, which would make D.H. Lawrence's novel look like Alice in Wonderland, on sale in supermarkets in London. And even so mundane a commodity as a bar of chocolate can't be advertised these days, it seems. You are turning it into some kind of object of phallic fantasy on the television advertisements. It's a kind of onslaught of eroticism in our culture. And it's meant that expectations of sexual athleticism in one's partner and of sexual ecstasy in oneself have reached dizzying heights. I suspect that not since the days of the Roman Empire has the general level of sexual arousal been higher than it is in the Western world today. And in that kind of setting, it's not surprising if the distinction between love and lust gets rather blurred. So what is to blame for our shallow, unsatisfying relationships? Is it capitalism? Is it the sex-mad media? One recent study has suggested the answer may be even more fundamental than either of those things. I'm thinking of a book published back in the 1980s called The Habits of the Heart. Any of you read it? It was a sociological work, really, by a group at Berkeley University in California. And its purpose, its overt purpose, its main purpose, was to analyse the tension between individual freedom on the one hand and social commitment on the other. But one of the most significant findings which this group of sociologists at Berkeley made was to do with people's attitudes towards feelings. Now, they discovered something very interesting. They discovered that people could be divided these days into two groups where feelings are concerned. They were talking about Western society here. The first group, they said, were those with what they termed traditional ideas on the subject of feelings. Now, these people took the view that feelings should always be subordinate to duty. So they put a high value on old-fashioned virtues like self-control, self-denial, self-discipline, self-sacrifice. This traditionalist group saw love as a commitment fundamentally of the will, which should be honoured, in their view, irrespective of whether one's feelings about the relationship were good or bad. But that, the writers of Habits of the Heart stressed, was the old-fashioned traditionalist view. It was rapidly being displaced, they discovered, in modern Western society by something different. They called this new attitude the therapeutic attitude. On this view, feelings take priority over everything else. The important virtues on this view are not those that restrain the expression of the self, but those which liberate it. So not self-discipline, not self-denial, not self-control or self-sacrifice, but rather self-fulfillment, self-realization, self-acceptance, self-actualization. These, they found, were the new buzzwords of the therapeutic attitude. And it greatly affected people's ideas about love. Because according to the therapeutic idea, love was just the spontaneous sharing of feelings between authentic individuals. Long-term commitment did not necessarily feature in it at all. On the contrary, according to the therapeutic attitude, if my emotional needs weren't being met by my partner, I was perfectly entitled to sever the relationship for our mutual benefit. Now, frankly, I think there is much that can be said in favour of this new therapeutic attitude. There are a lot of people around who are oppressed by misplaced feelings of duty, not least in evangelical Christian circles. And the therapeutic attitude does them a great service by helping them to get in touch with their own wants and their needs. It emancipates them from artificial constraints, cramping social stereotypes that they never chose to play. It liberates them also from the manipulative pressure of other people who are quite willing to use guilt to control them, to get their own way. I've experienced enough as a pastor over the years to know that making a martyr of yourself isn't always the right Christian thing to do. Relationships can be abusive. Affection can be exploited. And in situations like that, it is very necessary to stand up for yourself. It's not always selfish to be self-assertive. Let me say that right at the outset. But it has to be said, when this new therapeutic attitude is carried to an extreme, it is very corrosive of loving relationships. Because if people feel justified in leaving a partner simply because at this moment in time they aren't giving them everything they want, well, frankly, few relationships are going to go any distance or achieve any depth of intimacy. Well, no doubt, capitalism and the eroticization of society have both played their role. I suspect that the Habits of the Heart authors are on the right track when they suggest that the root of the decay in loving interpersonal relationships these days is not fundamentally due to Milton Friedman's economics or R-rated movies at the cinema. It is a moral issue, dare I say it, a moral issue. In the past half century, in our culture, we have redefined the meaning of the word love. Love is no longer a sacrificial commitment to another person. Love is now an intensity of feeling within myself. I think that change has come about very subtly, but it is now almost universal. The word love has changed its meaning. And that, it seems to me, is why the Book of Ruth is such an important book for us today. It provides such a salutary perspective. For the Book of Ruth in the Old Testament is all about the difference that interpersonal commitment can make to our experience of the meaning of love. It's a story. A story that, like a candle in the darkness, offers a beacon of hope to people who are disillusioned about love, as many people today are. People who are weary of living in a society where the law of the jungle seems generally to prevail. Ruth wants to convince us that love, defined in the old-fashioned, the traditionalist way, if you must, as a sacrificial commitment to somebody else, that is the toughest and noblest kind of love. Ruth is all about loyalty and the cost that loyalty imposes. It's about putting the needs of other people above our own. Most of all, Ruth is about how God achieves his purposes in history through insignificant individuals who trust him enough to take the risks which that kind of sacrificial, committed love demands. So I want to invite you to look, not at the whole of Ruth, unfortunately, it's four chapters and too much for us in an hour, but just at the first chapter. You've got the text in front of you. And with your permission, I'd like to read it now. Let's hear the word of God then, in Ruth, chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law. Arriving in Bethlehem, as the barley harvest was beginning, Our story then is set, as that opening verse tells us, in the time of the judges. As you know, your Bible will know, that was a period, perhaps a little like our own century, when the old moral order was disintegrating. Everybody did what they wanted to do. Or as the author of Judges famously puts it, they did what was right in their own eyes. The book of Judges paints for us a picture of a thoroughly hedonistic society, a place of sexual brutality and criminal violence. There's a very horrifying illustration of that to brutality and violence in the closing chapters of Judges, where we read about the appalling gang rape and murder of an innocent servant girl from Bethlehem, and of the bloody tribal vendetta that ensued. You can read all about it if you want in Judges 19 to 21, but you better be warned, because they read more like the front page of some tabloid newspaper from today than you would normally expect from the Bible. Well, that would have been a tough enough period at the best of times, but you'll notice that to the violence and the criminality of the period, our storyteller adds a second burden, a cruelty of providence this time. Not only was it the day when the judges ruled, there was also famine in the land. Was this perhaps a judgment from God on the people's moral degeneracy? Was it perhaps, as we've seen in some parts of Africa in recent years, a famine made worse by their incessant warmongering? I suspect our narrator may intend us to draw that inference, because Bethlehem is the setting for his story. And is it coincidence? Bethlehem was the very place from which that gang rape I told you about in the closing chapters of the book of Judges emerges. It's also ironic because the word Bethlehem means literally the house of bread. So he's telling us there was no bread in the house of bread. Well, perhaps it's no wonder. How could they expect the blessing of God to fall on a place where sexual brutality and mob violence had become an accepted part of everyday life, as the book of Judges has just told us in those closing chapters? Still, Bethlehem was at least a city of Judah, as the narrator records. That is, it lay within the tribal boundaries of the promised land, the land God had given to his chosen people. And so I think we must assume that Elimelech's decision to leave Bethlehem and go to Moab as an economic refugee was an ill-judged decision. Moab was hardly the place where any self-respecting Jew would choose to live. They were idolatrous pagans in Moab. They made no secret of their enmity against Israel. They had done for centuries. In fact, the book of Deuteronomy explicitly prohibits a social contact between Jews and Moabites. So Elimelech's decision to move his family there was, I think one has to say, spiritually reprehensible, and all the more so because he took his two probably teenage sons with him. What chance was there in Moab that they were going to date Jewish girls? Now, Mahlon and Killian eventually announced their intention to marry local Moabite women instead. So I think we can safely conclude that, like it seems many men at the time of the judges, Elimelech falls very far short of being a spiritual hero. And maybe the narrator is confirming that suspicion in our minds when he records not only Elimelech's premature death, but also the premature death of his two sons as well. In an Old Testament context, we very well intended to read that as an act of divine judgment. Anyway, with all these men untimely removed, the stage has been cleared for what to Jewish ears must have seemed a rather unexpected and novel twist in this particular story. Because unlike so many of those militaristic adventures that we read about in the book of Judges at this period of time, this is going to be a tale all about women. Not women like Deborah, who go fighting battles and driving pins through the heads of pagan warriors and things. No. Very ordinary women. Women, however, who seem to have had more spirituality in their little fingers than most of the men in that period seem to have had in their entire bodies. Let's look at Naomi first, in verses 6 and 7. Note again what we find out about her. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she prepared to return home. I wonder if she had been a rather reluctant emigre in the first place. She's certainly keen to get back to Judah now. The death of her husband and now her sons seems to have resulted in a desire to rediscover her spiritual roots. Notice how the narrator puts it. She heard that the Lord had provided food for them. That's how she interpreted it. Moab had been a mistake. The Lord had judged them for it. She'd lost everything now. She didn't even have a grandchild to show for the last 10 years. It's time to go back, she says. Let's try to pretend these years have never happened. Let's try to salvage something out of the misery of it all. But then a thought occurs to her. And she says to her two daughters-in-law, "You two, go back to your mother's home, that is in Moab. May the Lord show kindness to you as you've shown to your dead and to me." See, when they married into Elimelech's family, technically Ruth and Orpah became part of that family. As married women, they forfeited their membership in their parents' tribe. But in this rather unusual situation, where all the men have died, Naomi sees that the best interests of these women now will be served by a return to their parental families in Moab. Many commentators interpret Naomi's words here as a gesture of rather exceptional generosity. After all, she's volunteering to say goodbye to the only remaining reliable social support she has left in her widowed state. I think it says much for Naomi's character, too, that her daughters-in-law seem so reluctant to take advantage of the offer. "No," they tell her, "we'll go back with you to your people." The relationship between mother-in-law and her son's wives isn't renowned for easy affection. So I think Naomi must have been by nature a rather nice woman, an exceptionally nice woman, to have won such a response from her daughters-in-law. I think we're intended to conclude that she lived up to her name, because Naomi means in Hebrew pleasant. Her suggestion that Ruth and Orpah go home was no doubt one more expression of that pleasantness, that graciousness they had come to expect of her. And their wish to stay with her, I think, confirms the deep affection in which she was held as a result of the nice person she was. But I can't help suspecting our narrator wants us to catch something else in this bit of the narrative. An ironic, perhaps even a sarcastic edge to Naomi's voice. When, for instance, in verse 8 she says, "May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me." It's my imagination, but I detect an unspoken implication there. As if she's saying, "Frankly, I think God could take a lesson from you two. You know, pagans though you are, you've shown a great deal more kindness to me than he has. I just hope he treats you better than he's treated me, that's all." And if we're in any doubt that there's that cynical edge, it becomes even clearer in verses 11 to 13, doesn't it? "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? It's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." Oh, yeah, she's coming out with it now. There's resentment there, isn't it? Seething resentment. As if to say, "Oh, don't stick with me, girls. I'm a loser. I'm a jinx. Things will only get worse for you if you stick with me. After all, what are you? Young Moabite women. Now, back where I come from, you will be the victim of all kinds of racial discrimination and sexual harassment. I know what it's like in Bethlehem these days. It's a jungle. Your only hope of survival is if you've got a man to protect you and provide for you. And what hope is that for you? What self-respecting Jew is ever going to take one of the despised Moabite race as a wife in his own country? My boys only did it because they were living in Moab. They'd have never have done it back in Bethlehem. Maybe if I had more sons, they would do the decent thing and marry you in their brother's place. But I haven't got any more sons, nor any prospect of getting any. And even if I did, you'd be past marriageable age by the time they were grown up. Now it's pointless you coming back with me. You'll only increase your store of bad luck. The only hope you've got is in Moab. In Judah there's no hope for any of us. Least of all for me. And No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you. There's still hope for you. The Lord's hand has gone out against me. Some commentators who identify this sarcastic, this bitter edge, suggest that it wasn't so much heroic generosity on Naomi's part as resigned despair that moved her to offer these two women the freedom to go home. She was in the grip, they suggest, of a hopelessness so abject that it had become almost a clinical depression. And that certainly does seem to be the mood of her greeting to the women of Bethlehem when she eventually gets back there. Don't call me Naomi, pleasant, she tells them. Call me Mara, that is, bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. It's almost as if, isn't it, that coming back to Bethlehem with all its old associations and memories, it raises her self-pity to a new pitch of intensity. One translator tried very poorly to anglicize the pun in those verses. Don't call me sweetheart. Call me sourpuss. This is an angry and a hurt woman. And she's not afraid to let the world know it. Beyond the range of hope now, she's been plunged by grief into depths of what I think was an uncharacteristic melancholy. But perhaps the inspired author intends us to learn something from her and from her harsh and bitter words. A lesson about coping with the emotional consequences of loss, perhaps. I imagine some of us here have lost people we have loved. Someone we love has gone. Maybe as a result of death, as in Naomi's case. Maybe as a result of a relationship breakdown. Maybe unavoidable circumstances have just blown us in different directions. Or maybe they just left us for someone else, as people do these days. Whatever the cause, if you've experienced loss, as I have to say, then you'll know the stages that go with it. The numbness of those early days that other people often mistake for strength. The deep sadness that engulfs your spirit once that initial shock wears off and drowns it in wave upon wave of melancholy and depression. You come out, then you go back in. You come out, then you go back in. Sometimes those irrational feelings of guilt and anger that surprise you and bewilder you. The strange struggle between fantasy and reality, that tormenting expectation that he or she will suddenly come through the door and everything will be back to normal again. The ache that finds no relief. Questions now that you want to ask that will never find answers. The regrets, the yearning for just one more opportunity, maybe to say sorry. Maybe to say thank you. Maybe just to say goodbye. And most of all, that sense of isolation, that private hell of utter loneliness, which is so exasperated by the well-intentioned but wholly inadequate platitudes of Christian friends who tell you, you'll get over it, old boy. Oh, you have your memories. But you don't want memories. Memories are just dust and ashes in your mouth, the trigger for fresh pain. A phrase of music on the radio. A fragrance in the air. Passing likeness in the crowd. Such insignificant and unplanned souvenirs. But they're more than sufficient to plunge your soul down fresh cataracts of despair. And if you've lost someone, you know what I'm talking about. And you will have no problem identifying with Naomi. Now, of course, there are some self-righteous commentators who recognize this negative mood in Naomi's dialogue and criticize her for it. After all, they say, Ruth was grieving too, but she seems to have found a much more positive frame of mind than her mother-in-law. Surely we're supposed to follow the example of Ruth and shun the example of Naomi. And it can't be right to hurl blame upon God in the shameless way Naomi does in this chat. Well, I'd be interested to know in your family group, maybe you'd like to talk about that, how far you feel Naomi should be criticised for the attitude she takes. I have to say, personally, I doubt the narrator really intends us to respond as critically as that. I suspect rather that what the narrator is doing here, rather like the book of Job, rather like some of the Psalms, he's encouraging us to empathise with the emotional devastation that loss has brought in its wake. Of course Naomi blames God. Many broken-hearted souls do. And it's easy to see why. God is the sovereign ruler of all human affairs. If he didn't take Elimelech and her two sons away from her, who did? You can call it the therapeutic attitude if you choose, but sometimes it's necessary to ventilate negative feelings, as she does here. There's nothing unspiritual about emotional honesty. Now, you could be forgiven for thinking there was, judging by the anally retentive stoicism of some evangelical Christians. Now, I think God in this story, this is my judgment on it, anyway, it's my reading of it, I think God is inviting us to be real about our feelings when loss strikes. Real as Naomi was real. In fact, I dare to say that one of the functions of all great literature, and particularly some biblical literature, is to give us words and stories that help us to do that. You must have seen that film, Four Weddings and a Funeral, some years ago. Remember that very moving scene at the funeral, where the young Scots guy reads W.H. Auden's poem over the coffin of his dead gay lover. Stop all the cut off the telephone, prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone, silence the pianos and with muffled drum ring out the coffin, let the mourners come. He was my north, my south, my east, my west, my working week and my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. A very poignant scene. But you see, what has happened there is that Auden's poetic genius has given that guy the words he needed to express the bitter grief he was feeling at that moment in time. And in the same way, by recording Naomi's bitter complaint here, the Bible is, as it were, giving us a way of getting in touch with our emotional pain. It's giving us permission at those crucial moments in our lives when we need to do so, to weep before God and complain to him about what has happened to us. In his novel, The Blood of the Lamb, Peter de Vries tells a story that moved me very much some years ago when I needed to read it. It's a story, part of the story anyway, is about a man whose daughter is dying of leukemia in hospital. And on her 12th birthday, he's making his way to the hospital, carrying a birthday cake in his hands like this, very carefully. But before he gets to the hospital, word reaches him that his daughter has just died. And so de Vries paints this picture of the man staggering in despair around the streets, still clutching the cake rather pathetically, not knowing really where he's going. And suddenly, as he looks up, he realises he's outside a church. And on the wall of the church, there's a crucifix on the wall, a cross with Jesus depicted on it. And suddenly, as he looks up at the crucifix, he explodes with rage and hurls this birthday cake at the face of Christ. When I first read that scene from that novel, all my evangelical defences sort of were aroused. It was, I told myself, an outrageously shocking and blasphemous act. But then when I calmed down a bit and thought about it, I realised actually it was nothing of the sort. It was certainly a very, very powerful symbol of anger. But then what is Jesus on the cross? If he is not a symbol of anger. Oh, I know the liberals don't like it. But the New Testament tells us that's what Jesus was. A symbol of the passionate anger of God against the evil of this broken and sinful world. The cross is the sign of the divine anger, venting itself for our salvation, healingly. The cross is a gigantic catharsis of the divine passion. In that cross, we are told, God reconciles himself to a sinful world. There his anger is discharged. But if that's what the cross means, if the cross is God showing us how angry sin makes him feel and getting rid of that feeling so that he can love us again, how could he possibly mind another father who has lost a child, venting his anger? It is an unjust and tragic world we live in. When we feel angry, as at times of loss, we need to remember that the God we serve is no stranger to that emotion. He's felt it too. I don't think he minds us expressing our anger. I think he knows we need to get such feelings off our chests if we're ever to be reconciled to what has happened, or indeed to be reconciled to him, the architect of our lives. I don't think we should blame others, and I don't think we should blame ourselves when we feel negative emotion. If you have any doubts that godly people can feel such things and cry out in that way, think of Jesus himself, screaming, my God, why have you forsaken me? There never was a better Christian than him. Now, Naomi's sadness will not last forever. It is important we remember that. This story does have a happy ending. But while her grief endures, I don't think there's anything in biblical religion that requires her to pretend she feels other than she does. In fact, there's every encouragement in biblical religion for her to articulate her sorrow in God's presence just as she felt it. And that may be a lesson some of us need to take on board. Yet, into this scene of tragedy and brokenness, there is in fact a sign of hope. In this first chapter, Naomi doesn't recognize it at this point of the story because it's coming from a most unexpected source. But we, with the privileged perspective of being listeners to the story, we can already see it. And it centers, of course, on the other leading lady in the drama, Ruth. So let's turn to her now for the second half of that story. In verse 16-17, Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." Now, although this statement occurs so early in the story, this decision on Ruth's part is in fact the hinge on which this whole drama will turn. In fact, those of you who know the story will remember this, as events proceed, we discover these two verses are the turning point, not only for the fate of Ruth and Naomi themselves, but for the entire nation of Israel. Indeed, it's not too much to say that God's entire plan of salvation for the whole world pivots on these two verses, on this apparently insignificant decision of a Moabite widow. There is a direct line of historical causation linking Ruth's decision here with the birth of Jesus Christ. That's what makes this story so extraordinary, so fascinating. So why did she make that decision? Why did she refuse to go home? Naomi tries to persuade her all she can, but the force of her logic doesn't make the least dent in Ruth's resolution. In fact, we read in verse 18, when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Literally, the Hebrew says, she refrained from speaking to her. Once again, the tone of the Hebrew doesn't suggest to me so much gratitude for Ruth's fidelity as the sullen silence of someone whose ability to fight has just been drained to zero by exasperation. Naomi is now beyond caring. She's doing the whatever side. She doesn't believe that Ruth's grand gesture is going to make any difference at all to her situation. As far as she's concerned, the girl's gone mad. It's falling. And of course, rationally speaking, she's right to think that. Ruth has every justification for going back to her own familiar world, as her sister-in-law Orpah had chosen to do. That was the sensible thing to do. Nobody could possibly blame her for it. And yet here she is, opting to stay with Naomi, knowing that in all probability, she is opting for a life of poverty, a life of exile from her own people, and of course, singleness. Why did she make that choice? Well, for our author, the key has to be found, doesn't it, in Ruth's own words. Look at them again. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. What do those words imply? Think about it. Well, for a start, they imply that Ruth has become a believer in the God of the Bible. She may have been a Moabite by race, but her personal faith has now become that of a Hebrew. No longer just nominally, because she happens to have married into a Jewish family. No. When she has been given the opportunity to go back to her old tribal gods, she voluntarily chooses not to do so. So clearly, her faith, the faith that she has embraced, means something personally to her. That's very significant. In fact, it's worth noting a rather interesting subtlety in our narrator's use of the verb return in this chapter. You'll see that word occurs several times, return. In the Hebrew, the verb return carries the literal sense of turning round physically and going back in the opposite direction. But it also carries the metaphorical sense of to repent or to be converted, to return to God. And when you think about it, return must carry that sense here in verse 22. For Ruth is not returning to Bethlehem physically. Why? She's never been there. How can we say Ruth is returning to Bethlehem? She's never been to the place. And yet the Hebrew text goes out of its way to say very distinctly, both Naomi returned and Ruth returned. But they can't both be returning in the same way. See what our author is saying? This is not just a journey for Ruth. This is a baptism. Her decision to accompany her mother-in-law to Bethlehem is a public identification with the God of Israel. Your God will be my God, she says. That desire not to identify any longer with the pagan idols of her own people seems to have been a major factor in Ruth's choice. But there is more to it than that. Again, look carefully at those verses 16 and 17. Ruth's words here are not merely a simple expression of personal determination. She is again going out of her way here to deliberately cast her decision in the form of a covenant. A covenant was an agreement between two people in the ancient world, a bit like a contract. But it wasn't a contract in the sense of doing something for somebody of a limited sort. A covenant was a promise to be loyal and faithful to someone forever. Covenants had the binding force of a legal contract to them, nevertheless. And they were associated with a curse. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. That's the kind of curse, the kind of self-invocation of a curse, which you expressed when you made a covenant. And uttering those words gives it the legally binding force of a covenant. Ruth is going out of her way to make her promise in that cast iron way to Naomi. And it's even more remarkable than that. Because you see, there is an extraordinary similarity between the form of words that Ruth chooses to use when she makes her covenant promise to Naomi and the form of words that God chose to use when he made his covenant promise to Israel. Again, you need to know your Bibles a little bit to pick up on this. But don't you remember? God had said to Israel repeatedly in the earlier books of the Pentateuch, wherever you go, my presence will go with you. And what does Ruth say to Naomi? Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Again, God had said to Israel again and again in those earlier books, I will be your God and you will be my people. It's part of the covenant formula. And what does Ruth say to Naomi? Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. See, the echo is so conspicuous, it has to be deliberate. Ruth is intentionally echoing the divine covenant formula in her own covenant to Naomi. Why should she do that? Why should she choose to bind herself so irrevocably and so solemnly to this other woman in a hallowed form of words so characteristic of the divine promise to Israel? Well, again, this is something you might like to toss over in your family groups. But my conclusion is this. My conclusion is that our author is inviting us here to draw a conclusion, and a very important conclusion it is. I think that though Ruth was a very new convert to the faith of Israel, she had learned something of deep theological significance about the God of the Bible. She had learned that the primary moral response which the God of the Bible demands of his people is love. And a special kind of love at that. Covenant love. A covenant love like his own. The God of the Bible is unlike all the gods of the nations in that he makes covenant, shows covenant love to his people. That is what had blown Ruth's mind. And she somehow discerned that what he required of her was to show the same kind of covenant love in her relationships with other people. Covenant love, you understand, is not a sentimental feeling. It's a deep personal commitment to another individual. As such, it's not something that our modern therapeutic attitude understands or values. By its very nature, covenant love involves putting the interests of another before our own interests, and therefore it has much more in common with those traditional ideas of love we talked about, associated with self-sacrifice and self-denial. I think it's very significant that covenant love within society, within the Jewish community, was breaking down in this period when the judges ruled. In fact, it continued to break down throughout that Old Testament period. Hosea, a few centuries later, would be complaining about it still. There is no faithfulness, no covenant love in the land, he says in Hosea 4. And because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. Israel was sinking in these days in a sea of moral anarchy. And at the root of that collapse was the abandonment of this ideal of covenant love in personal relationships. People didn't care about one another anymore. People didn't trust one another anymore. People weren't loyal to one another anymore. Oh, God had promised covenant love to Israel, but in her rebelliousness, she saw nothing to be gained by demonstrating the same kind of love towards one another. And she was reaping the judgment of God upon her callous selfishness as a result. The land mourned. There was no bread, even in the house of bread. When covenant love fails in any human society, the store of human misery increases. God has built this moral law into his world as inescapably as the law of gravity. And yet, you see, here's the remarkable thing. In a private exchange, in the middle of nowhere, between two apparently quite insignificant women, a different pattern of human relationships is emerging in the story. Ruth, the pagan convert, is showing a true-born Jewess precisely the kind of covenant love commitment that God requires when it comes to human relationships. Orpah, her sister-in-law, wasn't a specially bad person for failing to demonstrate the same devotion to Naomi. Orpah just wasn't a believer. Orpah wasn't able to take this step of faith that Ruth was taking. It was far too sacrificial for her because she didn't believe that there was a God in heaven who rewarded covenant love. She still believed in the old pagan God. But Ruth now believes in the God of covenant love. And that's why she chooses the way she does. I suggest to you that is the central lesson our author wants us to draw from this story. Here is a woman with a prophetic insight into the moral response God requires of his people. Covenant love. When we human beings abandon covenant love, we make a desert around ourselves. Often in the world we create, it is the weak and the vulnerable, like Naomi, who suffer most, even though they may be least guilty. And yet the other side of the coin is, when just one individual discovers the faith with which to make that costly sacrifice of themselves that covenant love demands, then judgment begins to lift. The desert begins to bloom. Despair begins to give way to hope. In the plane coming over, they were showing Lord of the Rings. Have you seen that yet? Oh, you must go and see. There is a scene in it when Galadriel, one of the Queen of the Elves, is talking to Frodo the Hobbit. And Frodo is feeling very weighed down and daunted by the power of evil, which is trying to steal the ring from his grasp. And Galadriel says to him, "Even the smallest person can change the course of history." Well, that's what Ruth is about. Ruth's decision to cling to Naomi is a watershed. As you know the story, you discover not only does the birth of King David flow out of this decision, but the birth of Jesus. And even at this early stage, there is a subtle hint cleverly inserted by a water to signal that we're standing at a turning point. She returns from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, arriving in Bethlehem when? Just as the barley harvest was beginning. Oh, so there is bread again in the house of bread. Well, well, what a coincidence. Ruth has arrived. Well, our time is slipping away. There are many lessons, many themes in this story that would be worth pursuing. Maybe you'd like to discuss them in your family groups. One is the role of women, for instance, in God's purposes. Ancient Israel was an intensely patriarchal society, and never more so than in the time of the judges, when violent male machismo was the established order of the day. And yet in this story, we are presented with a female hero who deeply affects the outcome of history, not by fighting, but by loving. In the current debate about gender roles, maybe there's something all of us, men and women, could learn from that. There's also, I think, an encouragement here to learn a lesson about the openness of God's heart to minority groups. If you read the story, you'll find that almost every time Ruth's name is mentioned, the catchphrase, the Moabites, is attached to it. It's as if the narrator wants to keep drumming into our heads. That's where this woman came from, remember? She's not a Jew. She's a Moabites. Why does he do that? Why does he repeatedly allude to her ethnic origin? Well, it's because Ruth has a point to make. Ruth is a classic fulfillment of the truth that God does not judge people on the basis of their colour, their sex, or come to that, their sexual orientation. He looks on the heart. There's also a salutary lesson in this story about the caution we need to exercise when we interpret biblical law. Remember I told you there was a text in Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 23 verse 3, if you want to know the detail, which said no Moabite was permitted to join the people of God. The Moabites were permanently excluded as a race from the people of God. And yet, what do we find here? We find a Moabite woman being celebrated as a spiritual hero among the people of God. How come? I'm sure our eyebrows were raised in Bethlehem when Naomi returned with this mongrel Moab. And I suspect there were one or two self-righteous types quoting their proof texts from Deuteronomy against her. The Bible says all Moabites are going to hell. We can't have her in our church, in our denomination. Now, the fact is, of course, the Moabites that the law intended to exclude were pagan. Ruth, though she undoubtedly was a Moabite by birth, had become a believer in the God of the Bible. And the thrust of the story is that a person like that has as much right to acceptance among God's people as any Jew. That's the lesson we're clearly meant to learn. But a literalistic interpretation of the law might have prevented us from learning it. The laws of Moses were written against a particular cultural backlog. They need carefully interpreted. These people needed to carefully interpret Deuteronomy 23:3, or Ruth could have found herself out on her ear. If that's true of the law about Moabites, maybe it's true about the law about homosexuals too. We need caution when we interpret biblical law. It's always written against a cultural and historical background and needs to be understood if it's not to be misapplied. But as I said at the beginning, the driving and chief lesson, I think, in this chapter is a lesson about love. We live in a world, as I said right at the beginning, where human relationships are proving less than happy far too often, where friendships are superficial, and where people are dissatisfied with their relationships. As in the days of the judges, there is no faithfulness, no covenant love. Therefore, the land mourns. But the encouragement the story of Ruth brings to you and me is that we do not have to despair about that. Things can be different. Little people can model a different kind of truth. Covenant love. I think this is a particularly poignant message for those of us who are unmarried, as many of us, I guess, here are. Perhaps we struggle with the loneliness that often goes with being gay. Perhaps we resent it. Deep down, like Naomi, perhaps we feel cheated by the way God has dealt with us. It's an understandable reaction. Maybe we will need to tell God exactly how we feel, as Naomi did. But the fact is, we do not have to wallow in self-pity about it indefinitely, because there is an alternative for us. There is a way out of this bitterness into contentment. It will require faith and sacrifice on our part. But noble Ruth demonstrates its possibility. She, you see, made singleness not her fate. Not her fate that she had to feel resentful about. She made it her choice. She committed herself in covenant love not to a husband, but to another woman. No, before you go jumping to conclusions, I am not suggesting this was a lesbian relationship. There is nothing in the text to suggest that there was anything erotic about the relationship. Though I have to tell you this. Frankly, if there had been an erotic dimension to it, I'm not at all sure the Bible would have felt obliged to tell us so. Because I think the Bible is much less concerned than most evangelical Christians think with the very private question of when and how people get sexually aroused and what they do about it. Now, this is a story about something far more important than that. It's far more central to biblical ethics than that. This is a story about the highest and noblest virtue any human being can display. It's a story about covenant love. And it proves to us that covenant love is not the monopoly of those who have heterosexual marriages. We can all show covenant love in relationships. We don't need to be married. I think of a single woman I met some years ago who abandoned her career in order to care for an elderly relative with Alzheimer's disease. It was covenant love. I think of a divorced man I know who has refused a very lucrative promotion to a post overseas because he wants to spend time with his son, even though he can only see him once a week. That's covenant love. I think of a student I knew years ago in Cambridge who surrendered his place in the Cambridge First Soccer 11 in order to take a handicapped child to McDonald's every Saturday afternoon. That's covenant love. I think of a nurse who accepted lifelong singleness as the price of her calling to care for AIDS victims in Uganda. That's covenant love. I think of a person I know who, in the pressures of a very busy and demanding life, makes space to be there reliably and almost instantly for his friends whenever he is needed. That's covenant love. And I think of two gay men I know very well who have lived faithfully with one another for close on 2 decades now, who've supported one another through periods of unemployment and serious illness and personal tragedy, and who are still committed to one another today. That too, my dear friends, is covenant love. You don't have to be married to experience the joy and the fulfillment of covenant. And don't let anybody debunk such love. I tell you, love like that has the power to change the world. See, what you and I do in the small and apparently insignificant sphere of our personal relationships matters. That's what this story of Ruth is about. Matters on a scale far beyond our own petty lives. When it comes to covenant love, an action that may seem pointless and trivial to unbelieving eyes, in God's eyes can be a crucial event in his great cosmic plan. As Ruth's decision was. She had no idea what huge weight of divine purpose hung on her decision that day to commit to Naomi. No idea at all. She knows now. Let me draw a simple comparison. Ruth forsakes the security of her homeland to share a life of loneliness and poverty in Bethlehem. Christ forsakes the glory of heaven to die lonely and ignominiously upon a cross of wood. What are we to call those 2 gestures? Futile sacrifices? Stupid waste? You see, in both cases, covenant love. Upon such individual demonstrations of covenant love, the destiny of our world is hinged. That is the way God has made our world. And it's that insight this story is trying to drive into our consciousness. I think it's in a very real sense what Jesus was getting at when he said that we had to take up our cross too and follow him on this costly sacrificial path of covenant love. This is a story then about the real meaning of love. It's a story designed to deprogram us from our selfish, individualistic, therapeutic attitude towards love. It's a story that's meant to encourage us to believe that if we really want to know what love means in its fullest and richest form, we must be willing for commitment and sacrifice as the price of love. Kenneth Clark, in his book Civilization, says, "We can destroy ourselves by cynicism as well as by bombs." That's a shrewd observation. It's very easy, when evil is in the ascendant, to become demoralized and pessimistic, and even perhaps in the wake of September 11th, a little paranoid. Many an idealistic person surrenders to disillusionment and doubt under the pressures of a world where goodness seems often to lose out. In many respects, that's exactly the danger represented by Naomi. She's a woman of faith. She's a good and a kind woman. But she has been reduced by the devastating impact of circumstance to this state of stubborn resentment and bitterness. She's articulating the complaint of every believer who finds themselves the innocent victim of an unwelcome divine providence. How can you go on believing in the love of God when things like this happen, we ask? The world is just too miserable, too pain-ridden, too tragic, too damned unfair for any trust in God to survive, except perhaps for a God of callous indifference. Deny. Naomi will discover that her cynicism was misplaced. God is love. And at the end of the day, the reassurance of his love is restored to her. How? As the result of her personal experience of the human covenant love of Ruth. That's how. That's how her soul is saved here. Because Ruth demonstrates covenant love to her. And if we are going to avoid the perils of cynicism in this broken world of ours, that's how we too must find our faith sustained and how we must try to sustain the faith of one another. We need models. We desperately need models of committed, self-sacrificial covenant love. And nowhere are such models more needed than in the gay community. And who on earth is going to show gay people covenant love if it is not Christian gay people? We have a role to fulfill. A role of testimony. In this turbulent period of the Judges, when macho men into rape and one-night stands dominated the world, it was not the muscular physicality of Samson's strength that carried forward the purpose of God and brought blessing to the world. It was the moral heroism of Ruth's covenant love. And it can be the same for us. Covenant love, sacrificial love. Do we really believe in such love? A love which is not merely an intensity of feeling located somewhere between the brain and the groin. No, love which is a loyal commitment to another human being. Love one another, said our Master, as I have loved you. Perhaps the story of Ruth helps us to understand what he really meant by that. Let's spend a moment in quietness thinking, and then, I'm sorry I've gone over time, I'm afraid I always do, as my assessment says. We'll go straight to our progress. Spend a moment in quietness, thinking about what God has taught us before we lose it in the Babel.